And I'll call this one an alligator.
Hey.
Abadi.
I guess it was Adam that named the organism.
Yes, he did.
Sorry.
I messed
everything up.
It's an alligator.
Is that a crocodile?
No, that's an alligator.
How do you know?
Shut up, Eve. Shut up.
You are listening to the Discovering Darwin podcast.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Discovering Darwin, a podcast dedicated to the writings and musings of Charles Darwin. My name is James Wagner, and I'm joined every episode by my two esteemed colleagues, Dr. Sarah Bray. Hi, Sarah.
Hey.
And Dr. Josh Atkins. Hello, Josh.
Guten Tag, mein Freund.
Did you just say my groin?
Mein Freund.
Oh, okay. My German's not that good.
Hello. Welcome. Welcome in.
Okay, so anyway, we're on this podcast, as I said, is dedicated to the writings of Charles Darwin, and this season, which we are coming to a close, has been dedicated to one single book by Charles Darwin, Origin of the Species, and we've been each episode pretty much dedicated to one chapter, though last episode we did two whole chapters in one very long podcast. But today, we're going to talk about Chapter 14, is that correct?
Yes.
And this is actually the last chapter where he's introducing new ideas. And the chapter title is pretty long. Chapter 14, Mutual Affinities of Organic Beings, Morphology, Embryology, Rudimentary Organs. All of that and more on this season, near season finale. We have one more chapter after this, the recapitulation chapter. But today we're going to talk about these ideas of Darwin's about classification and embryology. And so as you may know from previous episodes, we've sort of broke it down to vignettes. And I think, Sarah, you've thought the best to break it into four pieces.
I think so.
And what are those four pieces?
Well, I think we'll start out by talking about the first section of the chapter in which Darwin makes the claim that classification reflects the descent that he's been talking about the whole book. The second section, we will be talking about what Darwin calls real affinities and analogical resemblances. The third, we will be exploring embryos, embryology.
My.
And then we'll wrestle with
rudimentary organs.
Rudimentary organs. All right. So four parts. All right. Well, I guess we can get started, right? So the first section, as Sarah pointed out, is about classification. And I'm going to read a little bit long quote here. This is from Charles Darwin's Origin of Species, 6th edition, page 551. From the most remote period in the history of the world, organic beings have been found to resemble each other in descending degrees, so that they can be classed in groups, undergroups. This classification is not arbitrary, like the grouping of the stars and constellations. The existence of groups would have been of simple significance if one group had been exclusively fitted to inhabit the land, and another the water, one to feed on flesh, another on vegetable matter, and so on. But the case is widely different, for it is notorious how commonly members of even the same subgroup have different habits. So here he's pointing out that we do see organization in life, but it doesn't fit the sort of easy categories, which I think early naturalists would do. They would say, here's land animals, here's land critters, here's sea critters, here's air critters.
Mm-hmm. Somewhere there are monsters.
Yes, deep in the ocean or in the jungles. Mm-hmm. And so they would just be grouped by their sort of land use or habitat use. But that's not what he's saying. He's saying, look, it's we're starting to see that things that are grouped together may actually have completely different lifestyles.
Where did this classification scheme come from?
Well, it's always been around, right? Early Greeks did it.
We like boxes. As human beings, we really like boxes, right? Everything needs to be in a box.
That's right.
Yeah. And you're a lumper or a splitter.
Yes, as we've talked about probably at ad nauseum to you in the past, right?
Yep. That sounds familiar.
Well, I think also there was, it's convenient to have a conversation about something if you both are talking about, when I say sheep, you know what I'm talking about, right?
Was so, ist das?
I'm not sure who is with us today. All right. So, Josh, I think you're going to talk to us about how naturally, you were just asking, how do naturals do this? I think there's another Darwin quote about that.
Yeah, there is a Darwin quote. So Darwin is drawing a line from early naturalists who were exploring the world, looking at the natural world, trying to lump animals and plants and what have you into different boxes, as Sarah said. And on page 553, he gets into this and says, naturalists, as we have seen, try to arrange the species, genera, and families in each class on what is called the natural system. But many naturalists think that something more is meant by the natural system. They believe that it reveals the plan of the Creator. But unless it be specified whether order in time or space or both, or what else is meant by the plan of the Creator, it seems to me that nothing is thus added to our knowledge.
So he's saying using the Creator as an explanation isn't helpful?
He's saying that using, I think, what I interpret this as is using the creation to understand the Creator is kind of a lost cause, right? You can't really look at, a fine ornate table and then from observing that table get a sense of the mind of the person who made it.
Yeah.
Right. That's one thing that I gleaned from this.
Which is interesting because, of course, Darwin was trained by the writings of Paley, mm-hmm. who was a theologian who made the watchmaker argument, Josh, which is contradictory. Well, it's contradictory to what you just said. They would say, hey, look at this very complex table, and it tells me whoever made it is very smart, and they're very creative, and they have, you know, this vision, and they're not just a sod who has a hammer and some chunks of wood. They had to be able to really create this intricate, beautiful object. So they must themselves be very complex and intricate and have a sense of beauty. And so naturalists at the time were running around looking at flowers and plants and birds and butterflies and saying, these are examples of God's, the Creator's ingenuity and cleverness and intelligence.
I think the thing that's a little, one, it's some level of hubris too, to be like, oh, if there is a Creator that we can figure out its mind. But the other thing too is like, okay, there's a lot of different things. So how does a flower and an ocelot tell me what the mind of God is? It's a little mm-hmm. weird, right? Because how do I know, like,
because they would say, well,
how is it more than just to say like, oh, things are like, hey, he makes some interesting things. That's an interesting craftsman.
I think from my understanding, it was a transition in how you looked at God at the time, right? So earlier visions of God was very much a temperamental, destructive force that you couldn't make sense of. And then at that time period of early Darwin, we started having more of a mechanistic view of the world, both from like understanding Newton's physics, but also understanding how the stars move about and planets move about. So a lot of people started to think, oh, wait, God is very rational and logical. And the ocelot makes complete sense. It's a beautiful creature. It's got these organs for capturing and killing prey. It behaves in a way that optimizes its ability to stalk prey. And it's perfectly made to be a nocturnal predator.
I mean, like, I kind of get that, but like the idea then that there's something about the classification that reflects that.
Oh.
Right? Because if anything to me that says like, God has a flower stamp and then like he kind of like whittles a little more away and then he makes a little bit different one because, you know, right? That was Linnaeus's whole big thing is, right? What is the quote? Something like
God creates.
Linnaeus classifies or something
organizes,
like that.
Organizes.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I know, like, it's just a different time, but to me as a modern, obviously biologist, but just someone mm-hmm. in the modern era, it's kind of, it's a strange thing to try to identify with.
I think it's a neat thought in the same way that in modern forensics, we look at thumbprints or fingerprints that are left on a crime scene. If you believe that God created the earth, then some of that creation is somehow connected to him mm-hmm. and there's some sort of thumbprint or some sort of mark left behind by the Creator's hand. Mm-hmm. And if only you could understand the world as it is, then maybe you could glean some sort of insight. And I think there's something really romantic and kind of noble about it. I mean, I could see the hubris part, but I took it more as a, you know, I'm a child of the universe and I have no idea where I am and I'm lost and scared and I want to know more. And I believe that God created all this. So if I understand it, maybe I can get some sort of understanding of his mind. And I think that's a cool thought. I do.
You know, I realize what's sticking in my craw here is when we talked, was that just last podcast about, the distribution of organisms, That like the, if God did this, right, the null hypothesis should be things should just kind of be spread evenly, right? They shouldn't be clustered and all this kind of stuff. And that's what, I guess that's what's getting me about the classification too, right? Because it's saying, I don't know what it's saying if you're like classifying by God's plan. I think that's what we're saying,
I think it's saying that there's a unity of form because God made, you know, and this is, you hear this in modern arguments against evolution. There are kinds. There's the cat kind. This is what God made as a form. And then there's variations, but it's really just cats.
Again, I guess that's where to me, like, it takes away from this supreme being if it's like, oh, I've got a, again, like I've got the stamper kind of idea, right? I don't know. It just seems like, okay.
Does seem like it's limited in solving the problem.
Yeah. I don't know.
It reminds me also of the Gary Larson classic Far Side comic where God is making snakes out of clay.
We posted that, remember, very early on.
I love that comic.
I put that on the podcast. I mean, on the blog spot.
Yeah.
Well, going back to your point, Josh, and I think this is interesting too, and we kind of got off on a tangent, which is what we do. I think also that the reason that naturalists in the 1700s, 18th century could run around and look at the world and say, look how this gives me an evidence of how beautiful God is and benevolent and, you know, has a sense of beauty. Look at flowers. Look at the way an ocelot looks. Because they were ignorant of germs and viruses and parasitoids and tapeworms and, you know, the guinea worm, which, you know, kudos to Jimmy Carter and his efforts to almost eradicate this horrible, you know, parasite. So concepts of parasite, if you look at all of the dark side of life, you would say, wow, God's pretty mean.
Yeah. Isn't there a writing maybe in one of Darwin's letters where he discusses ichneumonid wasps, the parasitic wasps that lay their eggs inside caterpillars and are able to alter their behavior as their young are eating away at the insides of this caterpillar and saying, you know.
But keeping them alive.
Yeah, keeping it alive.
Just eating the non-important parts.
and saying, you know, I don't know if I can believe in a benevolent God because of this terrible organism.
Yeah.
All right. So somehow we got off on tangent here about, oh, but I think it's what you said, Sarah. We're trying to look at the contrasting view of classification, right?
Right. So is there a divine classification that we are just trying to rediscover as we classify things? Or is it more as Darwin thought it was and continues to say on 553 that, characters do not make the genus, but the genus gives characters. The one known cause of close similarity in organic beings is the bond, which, though observed by various degrees of modification, is partially revealed to us by our classifications.
What does that mean?
Well, I think, what does that mean? I think
it's the mint julep talking.
It is. I think, you know, what he's trying to get at here is that, look, these similarities by which we have always tried to organize organisms is really based on these shared inherited characteristics that then are modified through the generations. And so these things that we have in the past seen as some kind of divine plan are actually just the lines of evidence that all these organisms have a shared derived ancestry.
Mm-hmm. You know, and going back to what you asked, Josh, earlier, we have to probably contextualize this to what Darwin, now this is 1870s, and but the models of classification, we've talked about Linnaeus before, where he came up with organizing based on similarity of form. There was a Cuvier, Did I say his name right?
I say Cuvier, but I don't have any idea.
What do you say, sir?
I say Cuvier, but I don't know. Okay, Cuvier. I don't know anything about French.
So he published in 1817, I believe, a four-volume book of basically saying, hey, there's four types of organisms, animals. And there's the vertebrates, there's the mollusks, there's the arthropods, and there's the radial. Yeah, radial organisms, like, I guess, starfish and things. So he created that model of four distinct clumps, which is different than even Linnaeus and everybody else who did the great chain of being, right? Goes back to your idea of God creating these things that they improve themselves and move up the chain. So I think it's interesting to think that Darwin is writing about classification and trying to get these people to look at classification in the lens of his idea of evolution with descent, with modification, because it wasn't happening at that time, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Linnaeus himself really interests me because if you take a look at a species name, you have the scientific name, you have the genus, the specific epithet, and then the authority in parentheses. Mm-hmm. So if you flip open a field guide, if you have a bird book or whatever, and you start looking at species names, you'll see in parentheses a letter or an abbreviated name or something. And a lot of these organisms will have the letter L with a period. And that's Linnaeus.
Named them.
He named so many.
And we haven't changed them.
I got so many. I named so many birds.
Tremendous number
of birds.
Oh dear!
I just died a little inside.
Linnaeus Trump. Right.
So huge. I found this huge bird.
All right. So Darwin is trying to get the readers of the time to think about classification under his model.
Yeah,
of genealogy.
And I think what he's saying is like, look, have we noticed how things kind of fall into these natural groups? Hey, guess what? That kind of makes sense when we talk about my theory of descent, right? Mm-hmm. Because they're going to be more similar because they've been in these lineages. And that there's a poor, I don't think we pulled out any quotes about this, but he talks about actually how important extinction is to being able to identify these groups, because it takes out some of these gradations in between and we can see them as these distinct groups, right?
Yeah. And we mentioned earlier podcast how the concept of extinction was very controversial because if things go extinct, that implies God made a mistake. And so there was many individuals who totally rejected the concept of extinction itself.
Which is funny because, I mean, not funny, but it's interesting that that was still hanging on when extinction was pretty well established in the fossil record. Like you brought up Cuvier. He was one of the first people to really be like, hey.
And there was known extinctions in Darwin's time. The hunters collecting birds. And the flightless birds along in Australia and other places.
Yeah, like, even in the U.S.
Yeah.
I wonder, about the folks that were like, oh, extinction doesn't happen, when things went extinct during their lifetime, what they thought about that. Or like maybe that was just the downfall of man and that we're
horrible people. Yeah, not part of the natural system.
I believe the carrier pigeon went extinct, was hunted to extinction around about this point.
Wait, now the carrier pigeon's just a, you mean passenger pigeon?
Passenger pigeon. Yeah. The passenger pigeon went extinct around this point in time.
No, I think it's in the 20s. Cincinnati, the one that was in the Cincinnati, the last one. But you're right, probably in nature.
Yeah.
Late, early 1900s, late 1800s. All right, so this first section of the book is Darwin saying classification fits perfectly my model of descent with modification.
And I think, you know,
look at it that way.
Yeah, we try to kind of think about what the modern the modern take on this is. And I think Darwin frames this part of the chapter as saying, hey, guess what? All these classifications we've been doing, this just reflects the genealogy I've been talking about. And now I think today, modern era, we flip it the other direction around, which is to say, hey, let's try to take into account genealogy when we name things. So that our naming of things, our classification of things, actually reflects evolutionary history.
And you and I were talking earlier today, Sarah, about the sort of intellectual shift that biologists had in the 60s, right? So up until Hennig, is that who his name is? Up till then, in 1960s, biologists used traits, morphological traits, or different characteristics to group organisms and make them into whatever category or group they want. And And I learned, basically, Josh and I talked about this, when we went to graduate school, because we're older, that was sort of how we were trained to look at
groups. No, I'm not. I'm not older. But I,
you're not older. That's right.
I was.
But your professors are old like me.
I was trained by professors who were in their 60s and 70s.
And as I was,
Yeah.
And so we were trained to think about phylogeny, not phylogeny, to think about
genetic, just kind of more gestalt, right? Like here's all these characters. Look, they're similar.
Here's how you group
what's
birds
often
together.
Called the phonetic approach, right? Whereas, you know, when I went to graduate school, phylogeny had a firm hold where I was going, and here we're interested in the really important thing is figuring out, and we'll talk about this some in the next section. What are the shared characteristics, so that's still important. But what's important is that we have to identify those traits that are considered derived, like newly evolved, different from the ancestral form, because those show us this evolutionary step.
Like feathers on birds.
Right.
Maybe. Yeah. Except dinosaurs might have
Except
feathers.
Dinosaurs might have had feathers.
Yeah.
Well, birds are dinosaurs.
Oh. There goes my mind.
That's a good segue.
All right. So this first is a shot across the bow, right? Darwin's basically trying to get people to think about classification.
Hey, and I think he's saying, hey, guess what? You've been doing what I've been saying this whole time, actually.
Right.
I think that's really what he's saying.
Right. And I don't know where to put this, but I'll put it right here. We're talking about the sixth edition, which is, I think, 13 years after the first edition was published. And you pointed out, Sarah, that this chapter has a lot more material compared to that same chapter in the first edition.
Yeah, I sat with the two editions side by side this time, and I'd be like, oh, wait, here's two pages or a couple paragraphs that are just inserted. And mostly it's that he's bringing in, hey, here's something new that someone discovered. And so,
Which agrees with what I say.
Oh, right, yeah. Sorry, I thought you meant you personally, James.
No, nobody agrees with what I say personally.
Okay. Need a break for the transition in your editing?
Oh, thank you. Gosh, I forgot what we're doing. When we return, we'll talk about real affinities and analogical resemblances.
And beautiful butterflies.
You're listening to Discovering Darwin. Bring us back, Sarah.
Hey, welcome back. We are talking about Chapter 14 of Origin of Species, and we're moving on to our next section in which Darwin wrestles with what he calls real affinities versus analogical resemblances. And I think, James, you have a quote to start us off here.
Oh, yes, I do. On page 568, his quote is, "Thus, the shape of the body and fin-like limbs are only analogical when whales are compared with fishes, being adaptations in both classes for swimming through the water, but between the several members of the whale family, the shape of the body and the fin-like limbs offer characters exhibiting true affinity. For as these parts are so nearly similar throughout the whole family, we cannot doubt that they have been inherited from a common ancestor. So it is with fishes."
So it is.
So it is.
I love that. So it is. It does. It sounds like a
like
let
you should,
it be so.
Yeah. Like
engage.
And also with you. Like
yes, exactly. And that's also what it is. That is what it is. You're bringing up my Lucian roots, man.
So it is.
But you know, but he's saying what? The fins of fishes, though look similar to whales, are completely different. Built out of different material, structurally completely different. And now for something
completely different.
All right, so that was my quote.
So I just want to make sure that people understand. So maybe we should establish a little bit of vocabulary, right? So he talks about real affinities, and by that what he means are things that are shared between two organisms because they've inherited it from a common ancestor. The terminology we use for that now today is called homology. When you have, so that's the case of fins of fishes and other fishes' fins, right? That they are shared because they had a common ancestor versus when we compare a whale's fin to a fish's fin, that's an example of an analogy.
But if you look at a whale's fin in your hand.
Yes.
That would be.
A different kind of homology.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, you go in there?
That I don't know.
Homology. That would be homologous, right?
Right. So just the concept of our forelimbs as organisms that are tetrapods, that forelimb is homologous. But the derivation of that forelimb into being a wing happened two different times in bats and in birds. And so in that case, it's an analogy. It's confusing.
Right. And so to bring back around to James's point about the whale's fin and the human hand, how do we know that, like, what is the evidence that those are homologous traits?
Go ahead, sir.
No, you look like you were ready to go, man.
No, I wasn't. Completely not ready.
Well,
I was expecting you to shout, "The bones! It's the bones!
Look at the bones! Bones, Jim."
We can look at, you know, developmentally, which we'll talk a little bit more in the next section, they develop in a similar pathway. We can see that the bones, we can actually identify back bones to say, oh, these are wrist bones, and we find them present both in the whale's fin and in a human wrist. We can identify the finger bones. We can identify the humerus and the ulna and the radius. And so by that, even though we can see they've been vastly changed, we can still see that same structural similarity.
So there is this idea that the bones from the whale, the number of carpals, the number of metatarsi, and all these are very similar to what we see in our hands, which is weird when you look at a whale fin.
And Darwin thought it was weird too. And on page 582, he even gets into this, and he says,
"How inexplicable are the cases of serial homologies on the ordinary view of creation? Why should the brain be enclosed in a box composed of such numerous and such extraordinarily shaped pieces of bone, apparently representing vertebrae?"
What's in the box?
What's in the box? It's a brain.
It's a brain.
Brains. So, yeah, he's saying, look, why would we expect this type of similarity across disparate groups of organisms if someone intentionally created them that way?
Yeah.
Well, you know, when we teach general biology, homologous and analogous structures are probably, to me, one of the most powerful arguments for evolution, mm-hmm. right? Because and they're almost contradictory explanations. The homologous structure that you can look at, Josh, you're studying bats now, right? And so bats are flying around with a wing that's basically super elongated fingers mm-hmm. with skin attached between them, which is a different wing than a bird wing.
Yes.
Who don't really have any fingers anymore.
Right. They're all fused in that little spur, right? And then go ahead. I was going to talk. Like,
he's going to talk about bugs. I want to talk about bugs.
No, I was going to talk about pterodactyls we're talking about homologous structures, not analogous.
Right.
So okay, homologous. So to me, a pterodactyl is the craziest wing. So it's the index finger. Imagine your booger finger being 3 to 5 to 6 feet long. That's the super elongated finger. And then you attach a skin to the tip of it and then attach the other skin to your waist. And that's your wing. We have all these different wings that are made of the hand, but created in lots of different ways.
I think it's actually great that you brought this up because they're not homologous.
You're right.
They're analogous.
They're
homologous in the sense that they're made from the
same material. This is exactly where it gets confusing.
Yeah, but they were all derived independently, and we know they were derived independently because one uses fingers and one doesn't have fingers, and the other one only uses the booger finger.
Right.
Right? And so it's at the same time homologous in the sense that they're all based on this forward, the upper arm, right, mm-hmm. or whatever. And but they're also analogous because they derive that flight structure from different components of that.
And structure. Independently.
Independently.
Right. And contrast that with insects, which have wings that are not modified appendages, right? They're not modified legs.
Right.
Are they? I don't even know what they
are. Well, the idea is that they are modifications of gill structures.
You know, going back to your argument about wings, this is why, you know, angels are a problem.
Yeah,
the sole
is.
Reason,
where
right?
Where the heck were those derived from?
Is yeah. The only reason?
Yeah, that's the only reason I can't find angels to be acceptable as a concept.
I think Darwin were around today, he would be so excited by this field of Evo Devo. So Evo Devo stands for evolution and development. Okay, and so why is this so important? Well, what we can see is that there is this kind of ground plan of genes that are called Hox genes. All organisms, pretty much all organisms have them, from your lowly jellyfish to your human being. And the function of these genes, they function in very early in the embryo. And what these genes essentially do is say, hey, make a leg here. Hey, make an eyeball here. And they work the same way in all these organisms. So I can take a gene from a mouse, right, that says make a leg here and put it into a fruit fly. Yeah. What do you think is going to happen when I put this mouse leg gene into a fruit fly?
The fruit fly gets a mouse leg.
That's what you think, right?
I do.
But it just makes a mouse leg. I mean,
exactly. We were right, Josh.
Science is the worst. They're making
the island of Dr. Moreau.
Fruit flies with mouse legs.
That'll never fly.
Okay. Sorry, Sarah.
It just makes a fruit fry leg there. So
say that three times fast.
I know. So these genes have similar functions, and we can see how just by duplicating these genes, by changing the timing of these genes, that we can have modifications of very similar basic body plans.
So are we going back to Darwin's original counter argument of unity of plan? Like, you're saying that there's a sequence of genes that all life has that gives it a unity of body plan.
Yes, was that Darwin's?
Yeah, he was actually arguing against that because they had a creationist unity
right.
of plan.
Okay, right. Yeah. Well, I think like there are these two views, right, at the time of the great chain of being versus these four archetypes that you brought up mm-hmm. in the last segment, James. And I think like Darwin was kind of trying to make the difference between the two. But I think in some ways this is saying there was kind of there's this master set of genes that is a body plan, like front and back, up, down, leg here, leg there, eyeball there, and that set of genes is modified in terms of when it's turned on, how it's turned on.
But everybody copies. Inherits it.
Everybody's got it.
Because they're descendant with modification.
Right. And so things that we might think of as, quote, lower, only have one set of these genes. As human beings, we may have to correct this later. I think I remember we have four sets, but maybe I'm not right. So we've seen mm-hmm. events where these things have been
duplicated. Right.
Yeah. And that gives us the opportunity. Same thing where the segments that I was talking about with the lobsters have been duplicated. Once you're duplicated, now you have this potential to say, okay, I'm going to keep this one as it is, does its thing, and I'm going to modify this other one to do a new thing.
But, okay. And so, listener, you might think, oh, wait a minute. There's like planned mutations and planned changes. What Sarah's shorthand saying is that you create a duplicate version and there's not as strong selection to prevent mutations occurring on it because you've maintained the original form.
Yes. Right.
And those mutations on the secondary form, the backup system, are tolerated. And if they happen to give you an advantage,
great.
Right. It's not like they're going, well, I've got this new set. How can I mess with,
Let's mess with it?
So yeah. Can you apply that to the ancestor of land arthropods, which looked very similar to a millipede?
Yeah. Pill bug kind of thing.
Yeah. Versus modern, like, wasps and flies and things like that.
Well, I think when you look at a wasp, there's still segments along the abdomen, mm-hmm. right? And there's still three body segments in the thorax. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think you see that continuity of arthropod form, which is why I think it was Cuvier originally had one group called the arthropods, which grouped lobsters and insects and segmented creatures.
Like in terms of animalia, like 75% of animalia?
Yeah, almost everything's beetles.
Like, yeah, you're right, exactly.
Yeah, mostly beetles. Yeah.
Mostly beetles. Yeah. So. All right, so we have this notion that there are – this is a complicated one. I even just sort of complicated by talking about the flipper of the whale bat wing – the bat wing, the bird wing, and the pterodactyl wing. That there's homologous structures, which means they come from a similar body part, mm-hmm. and it gets modified in different functions. Mm-hmm. Whereas analogous are, as I always understood it, different body parts that get modified into the same function. And that's where I agree with you that you jumped on me on the bird pterodactyl.
Right.
But I think I've always thought that bird wings and, say, butterfly wings, beautiful example of analogous structures, right? They're both wings, came from different material. Right.
But, yeah, I still think that the three tetrapod wings. Examples you gave are also analogous because they're really derived from different components of, right? Because one case it's fingers, one case gotcha. It's a reduced finger, one case
so it is different parts yeah. but structurally.
But yeah. ultimately they are the forelimb that's being right. modified right. into a flat.
So, yeah, so this again is so this where confusing. Like it depends on your point of perspective sometimes mm-hmm. in establishing these things that, you know, we can see that a whale's flipper and a human's arm and a bird's wing are homologous.
Right, humerus, tibia,
right. We have all those ulna, parts, but the all those parts. Wing specifically of these different organisms are actually derived from different parts of that homologous arm.
Beautiful,
right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And if you look at bird wings, then you've got an ostrich wing that doesn't fly. Mm-hmm. You've got a penguin wing that swims underwater. Then you've got, you know, albatross wing versus a crow wing versus a hummingbird wing. Mm-hmm. They're all homologous to each other.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, it's going back to what we started off with, I think those are the most beautiful support to Darwin's idea.
Yeah, I think both in the terms of like looking for homologies where we can see the common descent, but I think the analogies are also a lot of support because what another way of talking about it is convergence, right? That there was some kind of selective advantage to being able to fly for these, many different groups of organisms, of insects, of pterodactyls, of mm-hmm. birds, of bats, right? That have arrived at the same solution from very different perspectives. And that shows the power of that selective force. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Cool. All right. I think we're done with this section. Do you guys think that?
I think so. I believe.
All right. Our next section is going to talk about embryology. Is that correct?
Yeah, a little extension maybe of what we've been talking about, but more specifically to the embryos.
The embryos. Okay. And you're listening to Discovering Darwin.
Welcome back to Discovering Darwin. We're going to continue on with Chapter 14 and discuss embryology. And I think, James, you have a quote to start us off here.
Yes, I do. So this is a section in that chapter where Darwin, on page 598, points out the value of embryos in looking at sort of the history of life. And he says this quote, "On the other hand, it is highly probable that with many animals, the embryonic or larval stages show us, more or less completely, the condition of the progenitor of the whole group in its adult state." Okay, what I understand by that quote is that he's saying, if you look at the embryo of life of organisms, you'll get a hint at what the ancestral form looked like. And that sounds crazy if you don't really know what embryos look like, but you know...
tadpoles. They look like tadpoles.
They do look like tadpoles. So like, you know, today, if we look at a human embryo, very early stages, we look like a tadpole. Like yeah. you said, Sarah, we have a tail.
Yeah.
We have gill slits.
Yeah.
We are awesome.
We have no arms or legs.
Nope.
Didn't need them. And so, and in fact, Darwin even points out that they're for vertebrates, for example, if you give somebody a very early embryonic stage, they have no idea if it's a bird or a reptile or a mammal,
chicken
or whatever. It's hard to tell groups from organisms apart at that early stage. And he argues that it may give us a hint of early forms. Mm-hmm. What do you guys think of that?
Are you saying that we were all tadpoles at some point?
Yes. Where our ancestors were.
Our ancestors were.
Yeah, I mean, tadpoles. What's the fancy phrase here, Josh, that this is?
Ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny.
That's fancy talk. I think we called that fancy talk last time we introduced it. Right. Yeah. Ontogeny. What is ontogeny?
Ontogeny is the way in which the embryo develops.
Okay. So the way it develops recapitulates, which is harkens back to.
Reflects.
Reflects, right? And then phylogeny, Sarah, you were talking about phylogeny. What is phylogeny?
Yeah, so our relationships according to descent.
So that three-word phrase, which when I was in grad school
we unpacked that to about 25, I think.
Pardon?
We unpacked that three-word phrase to like 25.
Yes, that's right. Because now it's not accepted, right? It's right. Not, it's as a truism.
Right.
It's not. But as a sort of rough sketch.
Gestalt-y feel. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because we just talked about us being a tadpole at a very early. I mean, that early humans have gill slits. That's kind of weird.
Yeah.
It was a good point in my life.
I miss my tail.
Most of all. Yeah.
Except when you fall down and you hit that
coccyx
bone. That's not good. All right. So that's. He introduces this concept. Do we have another quote?
I think Josh has another one for us.
Yes, on page 599.
Thus, community in embryonic structure reveals community of descent, but dissimilarity in embryonic development does not prove discommunity of descent, for in one of two groups the developmental stages may have been suppressed, or may have been so greatly modified through adaptation to new habits of life as to no longer be recognizable.
Darwin, what are you saying?
You just contradicted yourself, Chuck.
Well, sometimes this works out. Sometimes it doesn't.
But it always supports my idea.
My ideas are unfalsifiable.
They're tremendous, my ideas.
Just, so many fabulous
they're
ideas.
They're huge.
My ideas.
Just because you look different as embryos doesn't necessarily mean that you are not related from an evolutionary standpoint, right? That's sort of what he's saying here.
But if you look the same, you probably are.
Yeah. So
that's what he's saying, right?
Or also, if you look the same, you might not be.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know if he'd go there.
You don't think so?
You don't think so?
Okay. No.
Maybe not.
If you look similar in embryo, I would thought he would say, if you look similar as an embryo, it's because
chances
you have a common.
Are, because
but
you
if
look,
you're not... That
you're
doesn't
not.
Necessarily
yeah.
mean
that. And I, on my book, because I love to write on my book, I wrote next to that exact quote you just read, Josh, isn't this non-falsifiable?
Right.
What does that mean?
I was going to ask you the same thing.
I think it means that you can't prove that it's wrong.
Right.
Because he's chosen both sides.
Yeah.
He says both sides support me.
Yeah. And I thought that was very problematic.
So I think, and I don't think we pulled out these quotes, but I kind of understand what Uncle Chuck is saying here, because he says, hey, if we look the same embryonically, we probably have a shared inheritance. But if you look different than me, that doesn't mean that we're not, that we do not have a shared mm-hmm. inheritance. And then later on, he goes to talk about larval forms of specific organisms that, for different selective reasons have a really different environment, and he makes the argument that they have to have a different structure to be able to deal with this. And so therefore the natural selection on that critical stage trumps our shared evolutionary history.
Huge evolutionary history.
Well, the salamanders, he gives a beautiful example of yeah. salamanders, right? So salamanders themselves are weird creatures. They have a terrestrial life stage where they look very much like a land organism, especially some, but then there's.
Is that just newts?
Yes, you're right. The newt stage, very dry skinned, here in Kentucky. We have the, what do they call it? Fire newts.
Mm-hmm. They're. Well, red spotted newts.
Red spotted newts. And yeah. the terrestrial stage is dry skinned like a toad and mm-hmm. runs
they're
around the
gray.
Forest. The bright red ones I'm thinking of.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yes.
The red effed stage.
Red effed stage. Called. Right. Yeah. So it is completely terrestrial. And then it returns to the aquatic pond at which it was born, which in itself is very interesting. So they have this magnetic ability to detect magnetic north and reconnoiter their way back to their ancestral pond, in which they then go through a dramatic metamorphosis where their skin is soft. They have a big fat tail. They can swim underwater. Mm-hmm. And they mate and produce offspring and then die.
And they're not red anymore.
No, they're not. They're green. I have some great photos. I'll put them up on the blog spot. But the point is that the larvae of the salamanders then are hatch out in the aquatic environment, and they have gills. They have beautiful filamentous gill structures, and they swim through the water for those stages as perfectly aquatic organisms. And Darwin points out in this book, I thought was really interesting, a salamander that was adapted to high elevation mountains, who the larva forms have no gills. They're just, they come out and they're fine. But if you dissect the mother while she's still pregnant with the larva, you see inside her larva that have gills.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I think it goes to what you said, Sarah. You look at the embryo. If you look at the early stages, you might say, oh, this one doesn't have gills.
Right.
It's not related, but you have to either dissect earlier, or because selection has favored this transition of form earlier or later in its life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you put this ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny into the context of the time, don't you think that this, well, I shouldn't phrase it like that because that's not a good question. Do you think that this question of ontogeny recapitulating phylogeny would have been controversial? Like one of the most controversial things Darwin talked about, because he's saying, look at the human embryo. It's,
oh yeah,
it looks like it's an aquatic
fish.
Organism. Yeah, it's
and
a fish.
And then it becomes an amphibian, and then it becomes a, yeah.
Yeah. So to me, this is one of those pieces of the puzzle that really is kind of controversial.
Because it does link humans to being part of the animal world.
Right. And if you show this to someone who is against this line of thought and go, look, this is what you were like.
You,
for a few weeks, you were like this.
Yeah.
Then, like, how does that fit into the whole creationism versus evolution argument? I think that's fascinating.
Yeah, that is. But the interesting thing is, I think like the people who were much more on the like this is the divine plan thing still were recognizing these passing through stages that look like other organisms. So that's I know as humans we are very complex beings that can hold very disparate ideas at the same time.
Cognitive dissonance.
Yeah, but every time I see it, I'm just like, how? Because you know I can't recognize my own cognitive dissonance,
that's
but
the
I can
beauty of
recognize
it.
Someone else's.
Yeah. I don't know where I was taking us, other than it seems as though that's one of those things where someone could easily go, look, this scares me and terrifies me.
Yeah.
This is a truth that I can't deny,
and it really makes me
I can't deal with it. It makes me uncomfortable.
You know, the other thing that like strikes me about this section, in talking about things that we see in an embryo but we don't see in the adult form, is also really interesting in that, again, with modern methods, well, not even modern methods necessarily, that sometimes we see these ancestral traits just pop out, right? So every once in a while, you got a snake that actually has some legs.
Right. Whaling ships would pull up a whale whose hind limbs would
be
present.
Exactly. And so, like, we can see that sometimes it doesn't always get
humans
hurt,
born
curtailed.
With tails.
Exactly. And these are referred to as atavisms. And during Darwin's time, I think people were like totally freaked out by this stuff. You look at the Island of Dr. Moreau and Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and all of these things really are throwbacks to this idea that this atavistic thing within us may come back out.
Oh, yeah.
There's a part of the natural world inside us that makes us more like an animal than a person, and that's weird.
Really scary.
Oh, yeah. I hadn't thought about that. And then it could be released.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know,
the evolution.
You also see this in Lovecraft's horror fiction from the 1920s and 30s. One writing in particular where someone finds out that their great-grandmother was an ape, and he self-immolates.
Oh!
And he sets himself on fire.
Oh, my gosh.
So, yeah, these things, I just can't shake this notion of how would this have made a Victorian era gentleman or lady feel.
Freak out.
Yeah.
Well, and, you know, and we now use this as a tool in a sense. So, this was a paper that came out maybe 2006, and they had these genetically modified, chicken embryos that they actually got to express teeth, like made teeth. Right. Because, and it wasn't like there was nothing. The mutation was just that a gene got turned on that had been turned off. Right. It's not like they were inserting anything new. It was already present in that.
I think Stephen Jay Gould earlier wrote a whole book labeled Hen's Teeth and Horse's Toes.
Right.
Yeah, where the early geneticists recognized, like you said, just the genes were there, but they were either shut off or mutated, you know, sort of like looking at a sentence in a, in a book where it's got a couple of typos in it, but you can still
tell what's going on. But you're still like, going on.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I think you're right, Josh. How does one reconcile the uniqueness of yourself when you see at the early stages of your life, you're not dissimilar from a chicken?
Just a beast.
Yeah, just a beast. Yeah. Yeah. All right. So this is the embryo. Is there any other quotes that we'd like to read of Darwin on the embryos? No?
No, not a Darwin quote, but it's interesting to me that in doing research for this podcast, I searched for embryology in the news just to see what current happenings were like in embryology, because I'm not that kind of biologist, right? Like, mm-hmm. I do bugs. I don't do embryos.
Not that kind of guy.
And in the news, in Google News, if you search for something and you click on news, all I found were very pro-life, very conservative websites about how life begins at conception, right? Mm-hmm. At how embryos are people, how embryos are chickens, I guess. It would be interesting to ask someone who is pro-life, look, is a chicken embryo a chicken? Like, when you eat an egg, how does that make you feel? So to me, I thought that was interesting. And I remember you saying, Sarah, that embryology really isn't what this is called anymore, mm-hmm. right?
Right. Yeah, because now it's, you know, developmental biology. And there's still, like, there's still morphology being studied within that field. But I think it has become more and more about expression of genes, the development and differentiation of cells. So it's kind of gotten away from maybe what we call gross anatomy, like this large scale anatomy, into like mm-hmm. these like following descendant cell lines. And so I don't even think like anybody uses the term embryology. It'd be interesting to see even if any like undergraduate schools teach embryology anymore. I don't think anybody does. So,
no. And I did notice that if you go to the website of the journal Nature and search for embryology, you do find a lot of gene expression papers, mm-hmm. but not a lot about, you know, here's an embryo and here's what it looks like. And here's what we know about it.
Well, I think this whole idea of looking at embryos and being confused about what that embryo is it a chicken? Is it a human? Mm-hmm. Is it a crocodile or whatever? I thought it was one of the best arguments for Darwin's mm-hmm. view of descent with modification. And Haeckel, who did the original drawings mm-hmm. And made his argument that this really supports Darwin's worldview, was also very powerful. And then it became the target of attack. Yes. By those who wanted to mm-hmm. reject evolution. And it's kind of interesting to me. Their argument was, and it's true, so to make things simple, Haeckel scaled things mm-hmm. to be similar. And instead of saying, I'll draw all these embryos at week 3 mm-hmm. and compare them, I will draw them all when they have a certain characteristic. Mm-hmm. It may be at week 3, it may be at week 4, it may be week 8. And so you could see that.
And that he maybe emphasized similarities.
Similarities. Yeah. And, you know, at one level, you're right. Okay. He kind of skewed the data to support the similarity of descent, right? Of uniformity of embryos. But at the, you know, contradictory argument was, well, yeah, it's like saying, okay, the sky's blue. What blue is it? It's like, well, it's that blue, not this blue, but it's still blue.
Right.
Right. And so for Haeckel, his embryo drawings, even though there's a whole book titled, you know, in anti-evolutionary book mm-hmm. titled Haeckel. It's not a very good argument against Darwin.
No. And, you know, there was an article that came out early to mid 2000s that, kind of addressed the Haeckel quote unquote scandal, and where they took actually images of the mm-hmm. same organisms that Haeckel did on actually the same days. And sure, when you look at that image, it doesn't look as like towing the line exactly the same.
Because he did drawings.
Right. He did drawings because before cameras. But you can still, it's overwhelming the level of similarity. Even when you're scaling in a similar way, you are doing days in a similar way, all these things. So yeah, it's a straw man argument.
But it's a very powerful pro-Darwin argument, right? Why would all embryos be so similar if they did not have a common ancestor?
So
there's a great, for those of you that are kind of interested in this, anti-evolution slash intelligent design debate. There's a documentary called Flock of Dodos.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty fun to watch. That deals with like some of these issues. And at one point, the filmmaker is interviewing a man who is on the kind of pro-intelligent design side, who happens to be a lawyer. It's interesting. None of these people are biologists. We'll leave that there. But they right talk about Haeckel, and he's like, oh, you know, you people use these Haeckel drawings all the time, and it's at the lawyer's house, and he's got all these biology textbooks, and they pull out every single biology textbook, and they can't find a single reference to Haeckel in it. And so it's like they're fighting something that no one really bases any of these discussions on, mm-hmm. anyway, right? Like there's a historical component to Haeckel, but we don't use Haeckel in the same way today because we have
the stronger arguments. Yes, yeah. Exactly. All right, so Darwin introduces the idea of embryology, and then I don't know where I'm going with that.
And then he suggests, look,
I'm just looking for a segue. So you want
you can look at embryos and sort of you can look at embryos and it adds more credence to my argument. And when we come back to Discovering Darwin, we'll talk to about another set of evidences that lend to Darwin's argument, and that is
rudimentary, my dear Watson.
Rudimentary organs?
That's right.
Organs. You're listening to Discovering Darwin. Welcome back to Discovering Darwin. We're on our last segment of this chapter 14, and we're going to talk about rudimentary organs.
Rudimentary organs, my dear James.
And we have a quote.
Allow me to read from my notable publication. This is page 601, Rudimentary, Atrophied, and Aborted Organs. Organs or parts in this strange condition, bearing the plain stamp of inutility, are extremely common or even general throughout nature. It would be impossible to name one of the higher animals in which some part or another is not in a rudimentary condition. In the mammalia, for instance, the males possess, I see you touching yours there, James, possess rudimentary mammae. In snakes, one lobe of the lungs is rudimentary. In birds, the bastard wing may safely be considered as a rudimentary digit. That was the bastard wing.
The little nubbin on your chicken wing.
And in some species, the whole wing is so far rudimentary that it cannot be used for flight. What can be more curious than the presence of teeth in fetal whales, which, when grown up, have not a tooth in their heads, or the teeth which never cut through their gums and the upper jaws of unborn calves.
So many confusing things, Charles.
Ugh. Rudimentary mammae.
My nipples are hard.
You were trying, useless. You were trying to get me to laugh.
I was.
It almost worked.
It's getting hot here, but I think they turned off.
Yeah, they turned off the AC.
That's right.
It's not just because of James rubbing his rudimentary mammae.
All right, so Darwin's introducing the very last concept in his book.
Indeed.
Rudimentary
last
organs.
New concept.
This idea that there's lots and lots of creatures that have things that they don't use.
Right.
Or that are not, yeah, fully developed or...
Or are used for another purpose than the example that James gave us for purposes not similar to their original purpose, right?
All right. Do we have another quote on this idea?
Yeah, it's you.
Is it me? Oh, yeah.
Did we deal with Josh's quote enough?
Well, I think we're
sorry.
Done.
Yes, and he's saying that some organs are leftovers, right? They're mm-hmm. they're still there, but they don't really do the same
signposts
things.
Of their history, but not doing their thing anymore.
That's a great way to put it.
Mm-hmm. And actually, there's a quote on page 602 where Darwin throws out an idea, and I like this quote only because when I first started teaching at Transy, I taught what Darwin taught, what he said here, and it turns out it was wrong. And so,
I know what you're saying.
Yeah. So on page 602 to 603, he says, in certain fishes, the swim bladder seems to be rudimentary for its proper function of giving buoyancy, but has become converted into the nascent breathing organ or lung. And so early on, biologists thought there's, you know, fish with swim bladders, and then there's a few still living today, extant versions of lungfish mm-hmm. in Africa and South America, which have proper lungs. They actually can't breathe. They can drown. You can drown them. You hold them underwater, they die.
The coelacanth?
No.
No,
the lungfish.
Lungfish, okay.
Yeah. So the coelacanth is the weird fish limbs, which is a different characteristic. But the lungfish, a friend of mine named Jim Krupa, who's, I'd love to get on the show, he had lungfish. And I would go over to his house and we'd watch X-Files back when X-Files was on. So we would get together every Friday night, have dinner together, our couples together, and watch X-Files. And he had this lungfish that would come up every like 48 seconds. You'd hear, and it would freak the hell out of me. Just a weird, right. Yeah. And then in the wintertime, he would pull it out of the aquarium, put it in a stocking, and hang it in his garage so it would get cold and go into torpor.
Wow.
It would put out this mucus, and it would just like...
The Christmas lungfish.
The Christmas lungfish.
At the Krupa house.
And then, a coal, or is it a lungfish?
They're pretty weird creatures. But so when I first started working at Transy, that's what we taught. We taught, okay, swim bladder was a precursor to the evolution of a lung. So you look at goldfish that can go gulp air and swallow air into their swim bladder, and they can actually extract oxygen. That's not true anymore. We now understand
never was true, right?
Actually, yes, you're right. It was never true.
So what is the root? Like, so that means neither are rudimentary organs, neither the swim bladder nor the lung, right? Because they were
separate, totally separate organs. Yes.
So yeah.
What's an example of a rudimentary organ within our own body?
Rudimentary organ.
Well, is there one?
Appendix, right? Because I think when he says rudimentary, he means something that is like going away.
Like our pinky toe?
Explicitly talks about nascent versus rudimentary. And nascent is something that is on its way to becoming used for something else, mm-hmm. right? Versus rudimentary is something that's on its way of leaving us.
Out. Okay.
Right? Well, so the concept would be, okay, if you don't have that structure, you have a selective disadvantage against others that have that structure, right? So if it's a rudimentary structure, if you don't have that structure, you should not have a disadvantage. You should have no, you should not be hurt by the absence of that structure.
Right. Because everybody else in your quote unquote species also is equally not using that thing.
Well, right. And so like if I cut off your pinky toe, mm-hmm. it's not supposed to affect your survivorship, your fitness value, right? That would be the argument for how do you identify a rudimentary organ. Mm-hmm. But it gets kind of tricky because we do a lot of compensation.
Right.
Right? Yeah. So how do you clearly identify a structure that is no longer advantageous, but it is a heritage of a previous evolutionary...
Let me give you a little chuck and see what you think of this.
Okay. Throw some chuck at me.
All right. This is 603. He says, it is, however, often difficult to distinguish between rudimentary and nascent organs, for we can judge only by analogy whether a part is capable of further development, and in which case alone it deserves to be called nascent.
What does that mean?
To me, it means can... selection act upon, like, can this organ give you a selection benefit? Can natural selection act upon this organ?
So what's the advantage of my nipples?
The advantage of your nipples?
My nipples.
Just yours.
How come that makes you laugh?
I don't know.
Well, I mean, that's what Darwin's pointing out, right? Why do males have nipples? Josh, why do males have nipples?
I don't know. I don't know why you have nipples, James. I really don't. I also have nipples. I don't know if you know that. You're not the only male of the species Homo sapiens who has nipples. I don't know why the males of our species have nipples.
Well, I wish you could put his face on the block.
I know. This is, I think it's kind of interesting, though, because it gets into, like, I don't know if it's the same thing or not, but there's something that we call today byproduct,
mm-hmm.
right? Which is this... it's maybe a structure that you have that did not originate due to some kind of selective advantage. It could be due to a developmental history, right? Thus the embryos we've been talking about. Stephen Jay Gould was one of the people to really kind of talk about this idea of byproduct.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of the idea like, well, developmentally, mammalian females need to have nipples. Therefore, all mammalian embryos go down this pathway to make nipples.
So is it a Hox gene thing, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, like, probably a couple of regulatory pathways down the line. But yeah, mm-hmm. right? That we're under this developmental program.
And nipples go here, but right. in the presence of
certain
estrogen and other...
Hormones, they will actually develop into something that functions versus
that
not.
Makes sense. So the blueprint
like,
is there.
Like the snot trough. Right, is a different kind of byproduct.
Right? Right.
Like that little thing that right. runs like underneath your nose.
Oh, okay.
Right?
That's always been an interesting one to me.
Like a byproduct of your face coming together in development, right?
Right, that's the argument. So we're talking about that little divot. I think there's actually a technical name for it.
Everybody like touch the tip.
Philtrum? Something like that.
Everyone who's listening, touch the tip of your nose yes. and then pull your
slide
nose.
Slide it down.
Yep, slide your finger down. And now you're touching just above your upper lip. And that's the snot trough.
Right. That's what Sarah calls it. Now, Sarah, you're right. So one argument is that's a byproduct of facial development, mm-hmm. which is the two sides of the face.
Of course, why don't we have
exactly.
our face?
Wait, before you get there.
Oh.
So the face grows together and then meets in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where cleft palates come
right.
from.
Yeah.
If your two halves don't meet exactly in the middle, you get a cleft palate. But I agree with you
that's
completely.
That's where my cleft palate comes from.
You have one?
No. You looked at me like, that's where your cleft palate.
That's where
oh, where your cleft palate comes from. Sarah. Those in the list. Not that we're judging. But I think you're right, Sarah. This is, to me, the most intriguing thing about the snot trough. Because if the – I know Josh is just losing it over there. If the face does do what we just said, fuses right down the middle, then that snot trough should continue – and some people do have it on their nose. They have this really sharp dent in their nose. And then some people have a really sharp dent between their eyebrows.
Oh, I never thought about that before.
Yeah. But most of the time it's lost, totally right. lost in the forehead. Nobody has it. And then some people have it in their chin,
yeah.
right? You know, the famous actors with a real dimpled yeah. chin.
Like Jay Leno.
Yeah. But the fact that we lose it in most like of the body, but really maintain it in the nose is interesting to me.
Yeah, that is interesting.
Is it really a remnant of yeah. a rudimentary organ, or is it actually a signal saying, hey, my development is good. I'm symmetrical.
Look at my snot yeah. trough.
Look at my snot trough.
Look,
and it's,
my nose is even on either side of my snot trough.
There you go. I don't know. I think it's I think it's weird that it's retained in one spot and lost in the rest of the face.
So
I don't know why we got there.
Where were we going with
this? Well, I was going to ask, when you two teach evolution in class, when you're teaching – think back to BI, I guess. When you're teaching these students about rudimentary organs, what examples do you use? Or is that something yeah. that you sort of pass
No,
over?
No. I think vestigial trait. So another word for this, I guess in the extreme maybe, mm-hmm. you could say, is vestigial traits, which is to say you still have this thing that has essentially, we like to say, zero function, right? So you can think of, you can find whales with pelvises. Still present.
Snakes
right?
with pelvises.
Snakes with pelvises. The famous example in humans, right, is the appendix.
But even better.
But how vestigial is that?
I think the muscles that we have to move our ears.
Oh, yeah, right.
So some people can still control and move each ear individually.
I can if I think really hard about it.
And Josh is moving his hairline. He doesn't realize that he's actually moving his hairline up there. But we have these weird muscles in our head that connect to our ears and move our ears, much like your dog moves its ears or your cat moves its ears, but we don't do it anymore. But some people can. You go on YouTube, you'll find videos of people like really having amazing control.
This has been going around Facebook too, though. The ligament in your wrist, right? That you can.
Whether you have that secondary ligament, some people do and some people don't. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What about your tailbone?
That's a good example.
That's excellent.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's rudimentary. And there's still humans born today where they actually just cut it off at birth. Right. So they never knew they had it. To I guess avoid embarrassment and fitting their clothes. I guess it would be difficult to find clothes that fit.
And human tails look weird.
Yeah.
Why?
No offense to any listeners who have tails.
We apologize. We're not judgmental. Well, wisdom teeth.
Okay.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's I pull classes often and ask how many students have no wisdom teeth because they were not born.
Right.
With wisdom teeth. And I'm always shocked at one or two students raise their hands. I have no wisdom teeth. Or I have one set, which is interesting.
Really?
Yeah.
And they're often removed, right?
Well, they're often removed because,
I have mine.
Do you?
I have three. I had three of four.
I wish I had kept mine because now I've lost molars that they would have replaced had they popped in. But yeah, there's an argument about the role of wisdom teeth as being rudimentary or secondary. So these things, these sort of architectural leftovers from ancestral past, I think is a beautiful example of what Darwin would argue, right? Because he's like, if creation, if we are built on a model of creation, there should be no extra stuff, right?
Absolutely not.
Yeah. All right. So I think, is there anything else on the rudimentary organs that we would like to read or talk about?
Did we really get at the idea that why would Darwin have brought this up? What is it about rudimentary organs that Darwin would have used as evidence for or against either for his theory or as a criticism of his theory?
Well, never criticize his theory. His theory is always right.
I think it's interesting that, I think it's a great nail. It's just why the hell would you have any of these things except that it's just a trace of your past? And in some ways, I feel like he didn't really, go as hard on that as he could, but I think he gave an interesting analogy in his writing. This is on 608. Rudimentary organs may be compared with the letters in a word, still retained in the spelling, but become useless in the pronunciation, but which serve as a clue to its derivation. On the view of descent with modification, we may conclude that the existence of organs in a rudimentary, imperfect, and useless condition, or quite aborted, far from presenting a strange difficulty, as they assuredly do on an old doctrine of creation, might even have been anticipated in accordance with the views here explained.
I just never realized how great that sentence is.
It's awesome.
Yeah. So, I think he would make the argument it's a very powerful and in support of his idea.
Yeah.
Wow. We'll put some better examples of rudimentary organs on the blog spot for you. Maybe some videos of humans moving their ears. Maybe Josh.
Maybe me.
Maybe even Josh. And we have one more chapter to do.
Yeah.
The recapitulation chapter, where Darwin iterates. Now, I say the word... I don't think... See, this
you
is the problem.
Agree?
Well, here's the problem I have with the word reiterates. I think people use the word incorrectly. Reiterate means to iterate again.
Yes.
And he's just iterating the first time. To reiterate would be, I'm going to say this, and now I'm going to say it again, saying it again.
Yeah.
He's just iterating it.
But he had made those arguments.
Right, so he's iterating them. If he makes the argument a third time, that would be a reiteration.
But he made the argument in, each chapter.
Right.
Thus iterating them.
Yeah.
So, no. Iteration. What is iteration? Iteration is to repeat. I thought iteration is to repeat.
What does iteration mean?
Is to repeat.
I don't know.
And so to reiterate is to re-repeat. I think people use the word reiteration wrong.
You're right, James. You are right in mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
it is iterate, verb, perform or utter repeatedly.
Right. And to reiterate means to re-repeat, which he's not doing. He's
iterate.
Just repeating.
To
so he's iterating.
Again or repeatedly. Interesting.
I've always found that very problematic.
I mean, even in this particular chapter, we have said, even within a subsection, he says the same thing over and over again. So has he not iterating
and also reiterating?
Yes. I'm just saying that people use the word reiterate incorrectly most of the time.
All right.
They often...
Fair enough.
Yeah. They're only iterating, but they've elevated it.
I feel that if anyone who has ever attended a faculty meeting would know that we iterate and reiterate
and reiterate.
That's true.
All right. Well, I think we're done. Are we done?
With this episode, yeah.
With this episode. We're good.
One more.
One more. Excellent. Well, we thank you for taking your time listening to us blather on about Charles Darwin. The next episode is recapitulation and conclusion.
What do you? Can you recapitulate if you haven't capitulated?
Ooh, I don't know, Josh.
Have we capitulated yet? I think we're yet to capitulate.
I feel like when you capitulate, you give in. It's not a capitulation.
Hang on, I've got a smartphone.
So, nonetheless, we have one more episode for you. And we hope you'll join us. Again, thank you for listening to Discovering Darwin. My name is James. Good night, Josh.
Good night, James.
Good night, Sarah.
Nighty night. Okay, I'm going to say it one way, and then you can choose the other way. Where Darwin would frickin' jizz himself if he knew what we did.
I'm going to choose the other way.
Okay.
Oh, my. Oh, 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 oh.